Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Let's just do a very quick review. What we did last week on the first page of your sheet, we have the actual 9 verses of the Tower of Babel, the entire story that describes the dispersion of the people, the confusion of language, and so the numerous languages that we have today takes up all of 9 psukim. We did the first 4 or 5 psukim last week, in which we described the idea of the group of people who were living at that time traveling east. They were traveling east on purpose to get away from that which existed before, to get away from Shem, from Aver, from Noach and his family. They wanted to do something new. They wanted to create on their own. They found an empty valley that had no materials, and as Rav Hirsch understood and explained, there they set out to do on their own, with their own hands. We can do without God. We don't need His stone and His natural clay. We will manufacture mortar and brick and build on our own that which could not previously be built. We will do so. And what was the purpose of the building? To make for ourselves a name. So that there was no function in the tower per se, other than to show the greatness of this particular group of people. And what we discussed at length last week was the concept that a community is in fact a powerful entity. When people come together, individuals, and they join into a common purpose, that creates a much greater power than when the individuals function on their own. And that's the concept. God wanted it to be that way. Hashem created us different from each other in a way that when we join and band together, we create something far more powerful. The danger in that is, for what purpose do they come together? And if people come together for themselves, na'aseh lanu shem, let us make for ourselves a name, then the entire purpose of mankind, as Rav Hirsch explained, is at stake, is in danger of the individual sacrificing himself to be part of that community, as opposed to the way that it's supposed to be, where the individual gives to the community, but the purpose of the community is to serve the individual, so that the individual is fulfilled. The individual brings out all of his potential by being part of a community, not by sacrificing himself to the community. And when that took place, where people were just giving themselves to the purpose of the city and the tower, which had no other purpose other than let us make for ourselves a name, we see the danger in this endeavor, which we'll see a little bit more today. That was all last week in 2 minutes. Take a look at the recording if you want to see that at greater length. But let's just, one last point of just what we saw from last week, just which summarized the entire purpose of what we had seen, was on page 209 in Rav Hirsch's commentary. There are sheets on the very back table. On page 209, on the left hand, on the second paragraph, Rav Hirsch quoted a Medrash. The sages in the Medrash summed up this story with the following statement, that if a man had a fatal accident at the building, they did not take it to heart. Person can fall off of the tower and die, and they would push him aside and move forward. But if a brick fell and crushed itself and cracked and was no longer usable, then they would stop what they were doing and mourn the loss of the brick and say, "Woe unto us, when shall we get another one unto its place?" And that statement from the sages of Hirsch, that summarizes the entire endeavor. Where was everyone putting themselves into the project, giving up of yourself, sacrificing your individuality, sacrificing who you are in order to have such a project. But it's really the project that counts, evidenced by how they mourn when that takes place. When a brick falls as opposed to when a person falls. Okay, now, let us pick up with the source. If you'll keep your finger in both places, we're going to go back to the verses. We'll flip back to the first commentary. We'll see some things in between. Let's start with verse 5. So the first 4 verses simply described their endeavor. Come, let us make bricks, burn them in the fire, as verse 3 states. Verse 4, they said, come, let us build a city and a tower. And the purpose, again, to make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed across the face of the whole earth, which we mentioned last week. When a community bands together, because they understand that they're all better because they're part of a community, what holds them together? Themselves, their own consciousness, the fact that they realize when we join together, we're better off. So the fact that we're better off together is what holds us together. There's no artificial means, there's no artificial glue that keeps us together. But a purpose that's only joined together for us that we should build a tower, we should have a name, but it's not for the individual, so that whoever's leading that charge has to continuously, artificially hold them together. Therefore, they had a fear, maybe we'll be dispersed. Maybe we won't be able to keep this thing together anymore, because there's no inherent coming from within drive, internal drive, to hold them together. Okay, let's take a look at some of the other, the back five verses. Vayered Hashem posakei, Vayered Hashem liros esair, v'yes hamigdol asher bonu b'nei ho'adam. Hashem descended to look at the city and the tower which the sons of man built. Now there are a couple of points in this pasuk. Vayered Hashem liros. Now, we're not studying Bereishis from the beginning, so it's not the most uncommon thing, but this is actually the very first time in the Chumash. This is only Perek Yud-Aleph, 11th chapter. This is the first time where we see that phrase. The concept of Hashem coming down, which is a very interesting concept. Hashem, which we know, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. What does it mean to say that Hashem came down to look? Hashem descended. Vayered Hashem liros. That's point number one we're going to have to see. The Ramban already points out there's another comment here that he makes, that Vayered Hashem, the name of Hashem that we use here, is the name of Hashem, the Yud and the Hey, and the Vov of the Hey. Usually, the Ramban points out, what we found until this point in the story is the name of Elohim. Elohim connotes justice, or Din, which we would have thought we would have found here. We would have found the God of judgment coming down to see what's going on with this tower. But we don't find that, the Ramban points out. This is the name of God as a creator. The name of God, Haya, Hoveh, Vihiyeh, that was, that is, and that will be, that brought the world into existence. So we have a concept of God coming down, which is the first time we see that concept. The name of God that's used, which attribute, so to speak, comes down to see, it's the creation name. The name that brings things into existence is the name that's used. And another interesting point in this verse is, so who's building the tower according to this pasuk?
Sons of man.
Sons of man. That's a funny phrase. The sons of man are building a tower. The sons of who else would they be? So Rashi, let's start with Rashi. Rashi comments on this. This is actually on your sheet. You could, number two on your next page. Rashi makes two comments on this pasuk. Number one, Hashem descended to see. Says Rashi, Lo Hutzrich L'Gachi, did not need this. It's not necessary for Hashem to descend to see something. He knows that already. Says Rashi, this is to teach the judges that they should not convict the defendant until they see and understand the evidence. You have to be involved. You have to be there to get it. Now, on a certain level, we see it's clearly a lesson as that. Rav Hirsch is going to point out, but if Hashem is teaching us that here He needs to go down. The tower. It's just like, what's there to see? When he went down, what do you think he saw?
Whatever he saw.
Right? He saw a building and a tower. Like, all right, so if I want to convict somebody, so you say, you know, you can't just convict from a distance. You can't get a phone call about somebody doing something wrong and say he's guilty. You got to go out there. That makes sense, because it's going to be complicated and complex to see what's exactly going on. But we don't. There's no complexity here. What did he see when he went down? A city and a tower. There's nothing difficult here. So first points out, clearly what's he going down to see is the intention of mankind. What were they thinking? What was their purpose? What were they doing? If I have this lesson that I'm going to teach that you can't convict until you really get a good picture of it, and here there's nothing but a tower and a city, it's not complicated. Something's going on in their mind. Something's going on that they're doing that they're trying to accomplish. See Rashi's next comment. The sons of man. Says Rashi, El B'nai Mi. But then, the sons of who else? So why is the Torah stressing that these people were the sons of man? Of course they were the sons of man. Were they the sons of camels and donkeys? Says Rashi, no. Who is Adam? When we say B'nei Ha'adam, it can mean the sons of man, lowercase man. What it also could read as the son of man, uppercase man. Who's uppercase man? Adam Harishon. What's so special about Adam Harishon that we would define this group of people building the city and this tower as the son of Adam Harishon? Says Rashi, the first man, Adam, who denied benevolence, who was a kafar es hatoiva, who denied the benefit that was done to him, and said, "Who is the cause of my eating of this fruit? It's that woman you gave me." Adam, who brought into the world the concept of taking the greatest good that a person can be given and denying it, and being a co-fair of that benefit. So these people were the same sons. They descended from that trait. They denied the benevolence from the one who spared them through the flood. It gave them life, allowed them to be part of this new world, and they wanted nothing to do that in their rebellion against Hashem. So that we see in here, now Rashi is pointing out that there's simply a rebellion against God in the lack of understanding of the benefit that Hashem had done to them. And as we're going to get back now into Rav Hirsch, Rav Hirsch sees a much more sinister, not only in denying in God, but the way that it's going to come out is an attack against the purpose of humanity. The purpose of the individual being able to function, being able to flourish, being able to express himself by joining a community. This is going to be a community swallowing up the individual, not allowing him to function. Keep this in mind as we go on. Before I read the next pasuk, I want to go back to the question that we asked. We asked two major questions last week, which I wanted to address. Now we're going to address the second question. The first major question was, what exactly did they do wrong? What was so bad about these people? When you read through the story, the text, we don't see anything other than building a tower, building a city, and they want to make a name for themselves. What's so terrible? So last week we addressed that question, that in the making the name for themselves, they were doing what we've been discussing, creating the community for the sake of the community, not for the sake of the individual, and crushing the individual as opposed to bringing out the individual. What we're going to discuss tonight is question number two. So now we have this problem. We have a group of people building this tower, building the city, taking up everybody into their cause, burning everything in its way. Why the confusion of language? Question number two, the big question. So as I mentioned last week, so God has this grab bag of punishments. Someone's doing something wrong. He peers down. He looks. He sees. Oh, this is a problem. Reaches into his grab bag and he can pull out anything he wants and throw it down there. Confusion of languages is an interesting thing. I mean, if you wanted to stop this tower, we had a problem, right? How about a couple lightning bolts? Drop a few bombs on the tower or on the city. Kaput. The city and the tower is done. The psukim would conclude, and they stopped building the tower because everybody was wiped out. Anyone here ever hear of Sodom? Right, we have a story like this in the Chumash. We have a people who are evil in the eyes of Hashem. He does not appreciate what they're doing, decides they must be destroyed, and he takes care of the city. And the rest of the world continues happily ever after. Why in the world do we have here a confusion of language? Why is this the punishment? Why was that the decision as God descends and he sees a tower and a city and he says, this is horrible? Let me confuse your languages so that, as Rashi says and has made funny, when the next person, made famous, when the next person says, I need a hammer, and the person thinks he said he needs a brick, and so he gives him the brick and he really wanted the hammer, so he takes the hammer and he hits the guy in the head with it, I wanted a brick, not a hammer. What a funny way to stop the construction of a tower. Why is that done? That's question number two, which we're going to address tonight. So let's take a look. So Hashem descends in verse Hey, Pasuk Hey, verse 5, like we just read. He descends and he sees there is a problem. Let's actually finish and go back to the other questions that we asked. Vayered Hashem, this is the first time that Hashem descends. So the Ramban points out, as Rav Hirsch mentions, the name of Hashem that's used is the name of creation. The Shem Havoyah, as we call it, the Hey and the Vav and the Yud. Hey and the Yud and the Vav and the Hey. Rav Hirsch points out that Hashem saw in this idea of people getting together for the sake of themselves, of the community, at the expense of the individual, as upending and being a threat to the very essence of humanity. And therefore the name of God descends, comes to be a part of it, because he sees a widening gap between that which was supposed to be the purpose and where the world is heading. And therefore, whenever you find this concept of descent, says Rav Hirsch, it's to bring the world back to its purpose. I need to come down there and sort of like pull it back to where it's supposed to be, because the gap is widening. They're going off. And at the name of creation of God, that godly name, descending down is saying, I need to get back involved because creation is at stake. And I have to be part of this and stop that which is taking place. Pasuk Vav 6. Vayomer Hashem, Hein Am Echad V'Safo Achas L'Chulam. Now again, let's translate. Shem said, behold, they are one people and they have one language for all. V'zeh hachilom la'asos, and this is what they begin to do. Again, take a step back. We have a tower in a city. Okay, it's a problem. What does Hashem do? The first word that he expresses when he says that there's a problem, what does it come back to? It's language issue. Somehow that language is the problem. Hashem says, look, I gave this people one language. They all speak the same language. And this is what they start to do? It's a powerful thing. The cause of their destruction is because they misused the power of language. Look at the next phrase. Rashi translates it one way, Rav Hirsch wants to express it in a different way. V'yata, and now, lo yibotzer mehem kol asher yozmu la'asos. You have it there in the English, I'm not even going to read it yet. Just as an example of how they read it, take a look at the second half of your additional sources page. On the top of your page, I have two phrases, the number four, which I'm not going to read, but you read it with yourselves, with your eyes. How many different ways can you read those phrases? Two separate phrases, they're not related, but just two examples of the same concept. You see them on the top there, number four? So if I read it, I would give it away, but they're just words on a page, right? Now the tone that I use when I read them will entirely change exactly what I mean to say. If I'm at a store, and I say to the clerk, I'm looking for whatever it is, looking for a new computer. And I'm sorry, we don't carry that brand. Can't help you. There's no way you can help me? Mm-hmm. Can I make that statement? And it's a retort. Really? There's no way you can help me? They can't be stopped? Someone's doing something. They call me up. Rabbi, you have to stop them. I say, I can't stop them. What? They can't be stopped? Of course they can. Or I can read it in the way that most of you probably read it when you just see them, in the sense of, there's no way you can help me. That could be a very different way of reading it. That's a harsh, you? There's no way you can help me. They can't be stopped. The intonation and the way that you read that will totally change that. Rashi and Rav Hirsch read this phrase of the Torah with a different, a little slightly different intonation, which you'll see will fit into the way the Rav Hirsch wants to read and the way that he's setting up this entire story. Back to verse 6. And now, this is the way Rashi reads it as a rhetorical question. So when you read Rashi, read with the parentheses that I put in there. And now, should nothing be done or be withholden from them which they propose to do? As a question, shouldn't we stop them? Hashem says, look, I gave them one language, they all speak it, this is what they're starting. Shouldn't we stop them from doing this? That's how Rashi reads the question. Like a rhetorical question, God speaking to himself, to his angels. Shouldn't we stop them? Should nothing be withholden from them? Rav Hirsch reads it as a statement. Rav Hirsch, again, in his picture, sees this as a threat to humanity. He sees God in his creative sense, in his creative trait, coming down to the world because all of history is at stake. And Rav Hirsch reads this statement as a statement. And now, nothing will be withholden from them which they propose to do. When people get together and form a community, they form a group, but it's not for the individual's sake, it's for their own sake. And they become a powerful entity that takes up all of the individual traits and characteristics and strengths. Nothing will stop them. If I don't stop them, nothing else will. They will become an all-consuming, powerful entity. As history has borne out, when you have a leader who's able to marshal in all of the individuals for his own sake to create something powerful, nothing will stop them. And therefore I have to, says Hashem, because nothing else will get in their way. Hava Nerda, verse 7, Zion, come. Rashi points out the same language that the people use when they say, come, let's get together, come, let's join, let's form an entity. The people say, Hashem says the same thing, come, let's get together and confuse their language, that they should not understand one another's language. So this brings us to our issue. Why this? Why is that Hashem's response? Let us come. Speaking to his heavenly host, let us come. Let's descend and confuse their language. Let's do Roman verse. Vayofetz Hashem osam misham al pnei chol haaretz. Hashem dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they stopped building the city. Now, there's something very interesting when you go from verse 7 to verse 8. When you read verse 7 again, what was Hashem's plan? He has a problem. He descends and he sees the world's history is at stake. People are joining together to become an entity, a powerful entity, but not for the sake of God, for their own sake, to make themselves a name. And the individual is being crushed along the way. And he's got a problem. So he comes to a conclusion. What should we do? Confuse their language. What happens in the next verse? Where does that fit in? What was Hashem's plan in verse 7? And then where should they go?
Doesn't say anything.
No problem. Wherever they want to go. Let's stay where they are. They'll build cities next to each other. Somehow, from verse 7, let us come and descend and confuse their language. What we end up in verse 8 is then they get dispersed across the face of all of the earth. Why do we go from verse 7 to verse 8, from the confusion of language to being dispersed across the face of the earth? Okay, enough questions? Let's see how our first tackles all of this. You sure may.
So, is he descending with the angels?
Yeah, so Rashi points out that Hashem often speaks in that the royal plural to teach judges should go to descend, and they should also consult with others, even lower than them, because when you make a major decision, a consultation should be had with others. Even if you are the leader, you should still consult with people around you. And that's all derived from the way that Hashem speaks in that plural language. Right, correct. It's as you find that commonly throughout the Torah, this where Hashem speaks in that plural language. Okay. The first writes, if you want to follow this a little bit inside, I'm going to do most of it outside. On page 213, we'll start there in the middle of the page, on page 213. Let's just start with his words in the beginning, just to get us started. What are the elements that form words and language? Here we have this concept. The big questions on our table are, why is this the particular method that's chosen to stop this particular building? Why is it so significant? And why is the power of their unity of language seen as the problem that Hashem comes down and sees, look, they all speak the same language, we must stop this problem. So there are two elements that form words and language. There are at least, that can be two, an objective one and a subjective one. Let's start with the subjective concept, that a language is made up of subjective words. So we started this already last week. I'll bring the same example just to get us started, what we said last week. Last week, if I made the statement and I said, I have an unbelievable story to tell you, you'd believe me or you wouldn't believe me? So you all agree that you would believe me. So I asked on you, how could you believe me? I just told you that my story was unbelievable. So why would you believe me? So, because we agree that the subjective meaning of the word unbelievable doesn't really mean unbelievable. It just means amazing or fantastic. Even though I said unbelievable. And languages are all like that, where there's a subjective meaning attributed to it, where we give certain meanings to things because of the agreed upon understanding that we have for what that meaning should be. And languages are different in the meanings that they attribute to certain words. For example, an example is the word charity. Anyone know the root of the word charity, the etymology of the word charity? Nobody speaks Latin here? So it's something like charis, I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly. It comes from a Latin word, charis, which means loving kindness. So the word of charity, reaching into your pocket and taking out some money and giving it to a person at your door, when we say the English word charity, comes from a root that means loving kindness. Developed in the Christian world, where the idea of giving charity was an expression of loving kindness. And what word do we use in Hebrew, for example, for charity? And the root of that word is? Tzedek, which is righteousness or din, or judgments, a different, totally different concept. Conceptually, the idea of when we speak the language of reaching into your pocket and giving somebody else money is that none of us think of it this way either way, but conceptually is a very different concept whether or not it's a matter of loving kindness or whether or not it's an expression of tzedek. Those are different concepts that are being expressed when you do something. The word for... So in many different languages, we have different ways of expressing things which are born out of the culture that gave rise to those particular words. We, for example, last week, Rav Hirsch points out that in the German language for a leader is the word Herr, which has a connotation of, as he writes, he brings an example on the next page, which is a very domineering type of word. We have two words in Hebrew, for example, to express a leader. One we spoke about last week is a nasi. A nasi is a prince. Also, as we mentioned, is a cloud. Because the real prince, the real leader of the Jewish people, has the ability, like a cloud, to gather all the evaporated water, be a holding point, a repository for all of that, and then be able to dispense it back to the people, to the world in the form of rain, that's what a leader is able to do, to gather all the strength and then give it back to the right people when they need it. There's another word for leader, which is the word Adon. Now, Adon is also a master or leader, but that's rooted in the Torah, a very different kind of word. Which anyone know where is the word Adon or Adanim come in the is found in the Torah? That's from the word of master. There are Adonim, or part of the Mishkan. Any takers? They were the sockets which went in the bottom of the Mishkan, which held the walls in place. So an Adon, a master, is really like a socket. It's the base of the wall that supports everything above it. So the conceptualization of a leader, when we use either one of those two words, either an Adon or nothing, you're either on the very bottom, holding everybody up on your back, or you're at the very top, gathering everybody's strength to be able to give it back. It's a very different conceptual idea of a leader than some type of domineering type of figure who's just usurping everybody else's power for their own benefit. And the words that are used express, the words come from different places that express those very different things. And every culture has its own language. There are words in different languages which don't exist because they all express specific ideas which come out of that particular language. For example, one of the examples that I love giving, in Yiddish we have a word of a mechutan. Mechutanim. What's a mechutan?
Your child marries somebody, that parent. That's
correct. Much better than in-laws. It's when two parents marry off their children to each other. So the two parents are called mechutanim. So my parents, and my wife Rivki's parents, they're mechutanim because they married their children to each other. Rivki and I got married, so they become mechutanim. How do you say that in English?
There's
no word for that in English. It's as if in the Jewish world, the Yiddish culture, which gave rise to that, that's a very important relationship in Jewish life. Whether you have good mechutanim or bad mechutanim or wealthy mechutanim, stingy mechutanim, you like them, you don't like them, you have to deal with them. If there's a word to describe the relationship because there's no way around dealing with your mechutanim. It's as if in English you don't have to deal with them. There's like no word that ever was brought into existence to express that relationship because it's apparently not all that important. We have a word in Yiddish of a yard site. Everybody knows what's a yard site. What's a yard site?
Year's time.
That's what it literally means. How do we use it in Yiddish?
Anniversary of the death
of a loved one. There's a yard site. Or death of anyone is the yard site. That's what the word means. It actually means a year's time. In German, today means an anniversary. It just means the year's time from whatever date. So in Germany, they would actually say their wedding yahrzeit, which sounds very funny to us because we never use the word yahrzeit that way. Yahrzeit's only, it's very specific because that specific concept of the memorial, the day of the death of a loved one, is significant. We put flags up all around our shul with lights because it's a significant day. In Jewish thought, culture, philosophy, the day of the death of a loved one is significant in terms of the concept of judgment, the concept of the eternity of the soul. It's part of our world. So we have a word which defines that concept. How do you say yahrzeit in English? Day of the death of a loved one. There's no word for it. You have to very clumsily string together a series of words to try to express that thought. There's no need for that word because it really just anniversary of the death. There's just no word which would specify that particular concept. Because every language, the words we use are very indicative of the values that we have, the culture that we have, and we never develop certain words in other cultures where they don't exist. I like pointing out, how do you say in Hebrew, for example, in biblical Hebrew, how do you say, what's the word for fun? Well, there's no word for that in Chumash. There's no word for fun. That's a Western concept that things are fun, or we do things for fun, and purposeless. But in the Torah, there is no such thing as something which is purposeless, right? So you're making, right, zelo fair, the classic Hebrew phrase of zelo fair. Because there's no word for fair. There's no way to say that in Hebrew because it's like we have to borrow that concept from the English. How about the word rights? Like in America with the Bill of Rights, everybody's born with rights. You have to respect my rights. How do you say rights in the Chumash? There's no word for that either because we are born with responsibilities. We are created, we are servants of God, and therefore there are things that we must do. We are responsible for certain behaviors, we must refrain from certain behaviors, but to walk around and say, I have rights that you must respect, I don't have rights, you have responsibilities to me, you can't harm me, you can't damage my property. But it's not that I walk around saying I have rights that you have to respect or protect. It's from your perspective. You have to protect. You have a responsibility to me. Very different way of looking at things than when I come to it from, these are my rights. I have the rights to life, to liberty, to the pursuit of happiness. Those are lovely things. The Torah doesn't even have a word. There's no word even to describe that phrase, because different things, each language has things which were created and developed in that particular language. All languages are subjective. They have that particular culture's words involved, and the meanings of the words, from the word charity to the word leader, the actual words they have, not just the, which words are part of the language, and the etymologies of those words are all subjective. They come, they develop in that language based on what people want them to mean as they develop throughout the years, the histories, the generations, and it's a very subjective language in that sense. We can actually, as I mentioned, we can change the meaning of words, which happens all to anyone who likes to study etymology. There's a whole field of watching a word as it goes through the centuries, and it literally changes meanings as it goes along. You have to watch any film just, you know, early 1900s in England, and you just listen to the way that they're talking. Like you watch this in 100 years, how the words that they use, even today, the way they're used in England are very different than the way that we use them in America, and things are constantly developing a very subjective meaning as time goes on. The example we brought last week, I'll just mention again, I had a wonderful chat while I was online. And so in 1980, that would mean, and we would all agree what that would mean is, while I was standing online at the supermarket, I had a wonderful chat with the woman behind me. And in 2011, if I had a wonderful chat online, that would mean I was sitting at my computer and I was on the internet and I was having some form of a chat with somebody. And we would all agree it meant this. We would all agree in 1980 it meant that, and we would all agree in 2011 it means that. And the words have just completely taken on different meanings. There's only one language that doesn't share that subjective nature. That's what we refer to as Lashon HaKodesh, the language that Hashem created the world with. And the language that God used to create the world is what we would refer to as an objective language, as Rav Hirsch likes to call it. It's not because any one person decided what the word should mean that they are subject to change, but objective reality, the words are exactly as they are because that's how God created the reality of the world. So that concept needs a little bit of explanation. You have on your first sheet, I have a couple of sources just to take a look at to help bring out some of this point. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos writes, number 7, Va'asara ma'amoros nivra ha'olam. With 10 utterances, the world was created. What does it mean with 10 utterances, the world was created? So the Mishnah is coming from the fact that in the beginning of the first 7 days of creation, the only 7 days of creation, the Torah uses the phrase Vayomer Elokim 10 times. It's really 9, the Mepharshim discuss where is the 10th, but we have the concept Vayomer Elokim Yihi Or. Hashem said, let there be light, and there was light. It came into existence because of His words. Everything that He said, the utterances that He made, actually became the reality. The greatest analogy, this is real, that I've heard would be the periodic table in chemistry. You have a concept in which you have a symbol which represents something, or an atom, or a molecule. You have an H2O, two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen. When you put them together, you get water. That's the reality of putting together those different molecules together. Each letter of the Hebrew alphabet has that type of quality that when you combine it with other letters, it forms the reality. A horse is a samach next to a vav, next to a samach. When Hashem utters those words, that is, it becomes a horse, because that's what a horse is. It is the combination of the spiritual meanings behind all of those letters. There's an entire study of the letters, the beauty of the Hebrew language, all of Kabbalah. I shouldn't say all of Kabbalah. That implies like I actually know anything of Kabbalah, which I don't. Much of Kabbalah is based on that understanding of how the world was, letters were put together. Many of the statements of Chazal describe that Bezalel, the next thing on your list, the Gemara says about Bezalel, what was his greatness that he was able to build a Mishkan? Bezalel was Yodeya Haya Litzaref Osios, Shenivro Behen Shemayim Varts. He knew and understood how to combine the letters through which the world was created. If a human being could understand that power, you would also have creative powers. You would know which letters to put together in what combinations, and that would bring about a reality. The Aleph Beis, the power of the Aleph Beis, is the letters in which God created the world. I saw there's a Chassidus Shavuot that says, in the first phrase of the Chumash, Bereishis Bara Elokim, Eis HaShemayim, the Pasuk says. In the beginning, Hashem created Eis HaShemayim. Eis are the letters Aleph and Tav. So that you could read it as Bereishis, in the beginning, Bara Elokim, Eis. The first thing that He created was the Aleph Beis. And then from the Aleph Beis, when you put them together, you have the entire world. And their entire books is a great English book. I forgot who wrote it. I'm blanking out on it right now. It's called the Mystery or the Power, the Beauty of the Aleph Beis, the Hebrew Aleph Beis. And it goes through each letter, what the nature of that letter is, and then taking you through where you see in that letter all of the components of the language is just consistent throughout how that letter represents that. For example, the letter Aleph, which is the number one, the Aleph, the letter that represents God, the Elohim, the oneness of the world, Aleph, Aleph, one, the thousand. The concept of all first start with the Aleph, from Avraham to Adam. You just find that concept. There's another one in his list that I'm forgetting where that letter is represented by that, and all that's represented in the letter Aleph comes out in the word Ben, in the word the letter Beis. And how you have the Av from the Aleph going, a father starts with the Aleph, goes to the Beis, which is the next thing which comes after him, representing what a father is, starting from the beginning and leading to the next generation. And all the letters have that component in which you can take the particular letter. The word Bracha is an example that's often brought. Bracha has the three letters in it, a Beis, Reish, and a Chaf. And all of those are combinations of the twos. A Beis is the letter two, the Reish is 200, and the Chaf is 20. And the concept of what a bracha is going from one to two, from single to many, to having a lot, to plural, to expanding. That's what a bracha is. It's the concept of, and so the word bracha is comprised of the three letters, which all represent that number of two, 220, 200, Beis, Reish, Chaf, or it's how you can, and there's, we can go on an entire class just on the concept of the Hebrew alphabet, which I am not going to do, but that's the concept of the reality, the objective nature, so that the words of the biblical language, Lashon HaKodesh, aren't subjective, that they can change, that we can all decide that it means one thing in 1980 and in 2011 it means something else. What the words of the Lashon HaKodesh are the objective reality as to what it is. If you want to know what opening up your wallet and handing money to someone at your door, what is that? That is tzedakah. That's an objective reality. That's what it is. It comes from the roots of the word tzedek and all that's represented in that. And it's not that culture can say it's really loving kindness. It is tzedek. It is tzedakah because that's what the Torah says it is. In the world, the words that the Torah used to create are the reality of the existence. And that's why when we find very often in rabbinic liturgy concepts that go, poems that go from Aleph to Tav, because it expresses the entity of all that exists in the world. From Anan Zemiros, Kelodon, Eshes Chayil, over and over again, there are concepts of poems which start from Aleph and go all the way to Tav. You find it in Megillas Eicha, which we're going to read in 3 weeks, describing the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which also goes, I believe it's three out of the five chapters go from Aleph to Tav. And the Gemara says, why did those three chapters go from Aleph to Tav? I have that on your next, on the third of number seven on your sheet. Why were the Jewish people struck during the destruction of the temple as recorded through the Aleph Beis? Because they violated the Torah, which had been given with the Aleph Beis. If you violate the Torah, which represents all of the reality of the world, which was given with the Aleph Beis, and you violate that, well then your destruction is going to come about through the Megillas Eicha, also through that Aleph Beis. That being the case, look at number 5 in your source sheet, a fascinating Rashi, which you'll now appreciate and understand with that which we said. The Pasuk in Shema, which we say every day, you shall teach your children to speak in them. While you're sitting in your home, while you're traveling on the way. Rashi quotes on the phrase v'dibarta bom, that you shall teach your children to speak in them. The sages were bothered by the language v'dibarta bom. Why does the Torah say to speak in them? Says Rashi, Mishosha ben yodei ledaber, from the time that a son knows how to speak, you should teach him, Torah tziva lonu Moshe. That's what you, as soon as a child begins to speak, that's what you should teach him. And then Rashi adds, Shehaze limud diburo. Why, when the child begins to speak, should you teach him Torah tziva lonu Moshe? not just that he should be learning, but that that should be his pattern of speech. The limud diburu, the way he learns to speak, should be through Torah. What's the significance that a child learns to speak through Torah? Because now he's learning the reality of the world. When we teach our children in a foreign language, we teach them English, the way they learn the world, the way they perceive the world, is through the language that they speak. The language affects the way that we think, it affects everything about us. And they're now taking in the world based on a subjective language. But if you would teach him to speak in Lashon HaKodesh, then he would take in the world in an objective language. He would understand the reality of what things are because they are that way, because that's how he learned to speak. And the sages say something very significant. Mikan Amru, from the time that a baby begins to speak, Aviv Mesiach Imo Belashon HaKodesh. Therefore, from the time a child begins to speak, his father should talk to him Belashon HaKodesh. He should speak to him in the holy tongue, Umelam the Torah, and teach him Torah. And if he does not do so, it is as if he's burying him. The significance that the sages say, because now all of us are now working backwards. We were first learning a subjective language. We all speak a different language. And now we have to try to impose upon that the way the Torah wants us to think. But the language of the Torah is objective. It's the reality. It's the way that things are. Okay. With all of that, says refers to the following idea. Magnificent idea. We have a people all speaking the same language. They're all speaking Safo Echos Udvarim Achadim. As the Torah said, it's the same language, and they all are in agreement what the words mean. It's all that objective reality. And in that powerful objective reality that everybody speaks, look at how they've gone. They've now decided to take that power of unity that they have and build for themselves a city and a tower, not for the name of God, but for their own name, that we should become great. We're going to build something that has no purpose, just so that we can become great, lest we be dispersed. Shem comes down and he sees them building and says, this can't be. We have to do something about this language problem. And the way that I'm going to do it is by dispersing them, or by really confusing or adding something different to their language. Now, what is the problem again that's going on in the way the Rosh understands it? What has happened to the individual in this particular episode? The individual has been swallowed by the group. The group has said, come, be part of us. Sacrifice yourself. Give up of your individuality. Give up of your strengths and talents for the purpose of this tower, so that, as the sages say, if you die, we're going to push you aside and keep moving. It's the bricks that we care about, and we want you to dedicate yourself to this with passion and forgetting about yourself. And Hashem sees the individual is the purpose. I created all my individuals because I need all of them to fulfill their mission. I need them to be who they need to be. I can't have the individual being sacrificed. What method, says Rav Hirsch, does Hashem use to break the cycle of the individual who's been swallowed up by this machinery of community? Says Rav Hirsch, let's read him inside because his language is so much better than mine, even translated into English. Top of page 216. Let's do the bottom of 215. Sorry. Let's start from the bottom of 215. Bottom of 215 says, Rav Hirsch. Please go home and read this. I did this all outside. You can see there's so much here that I didn't say, but his language is beautiful and you read inside. But let's just do from 215, read a little bit inside tonight. The element which then could enter this universal language and suddenly cut it off from its old source could be nothing other than the awakening of the consciousness of the individual of himself. Now, what we didn't get through is that the way that first understood from the language of Hava Navla Sham Sifasham, let us confuse their language, is from the root of the word Naval, which literally means to wither. So that the language was going to be cut off from its original source. And the way that a flower is being yonik, is nurturing itself from the ground, if you cut the flower off, it will eventually die because it's cut off from its source of existence. The way that their languages are going to be disturbed is by cutting them off from the original source. And the way that that's going to be done, says Rav Hirsch, is by awakening the consciousness of the individual of himself. The attempt of the community by this building to do away with the individuality of the individual. What the community was trying to do was say, everybody, give yourself up to this plan. Sacrifice yourself to it. So how do I break that? I break that by the awakening of consciousness of the independent value of the individual. I awaken within each individual and say, wait a minute. I'm not giving myself up to some major ordeal. I am myself. I am my own being. And I'm too important to be part of this project and just sacrifice myself. apart, I have to wake up that independent value apart from his value as a unit of the community. The feeling dawned in them that every human being, top of 216, the Nimrod and the slave alike, is called to have the same freedom of exercising his own will. It dawns on each of them that they all have their own free will, that they are their own people. Obstinacy, in his own opinion, egoism awoke in the individual. He would no longer accept or submit to any point of view other than his own. What developed was the sense of, how do I break the individuals who are now being part sucked in to an all-consuming community? I make them feel so important about themselves that they refuse to listen to whatever's going on. Their consciousness is so strong, they don't want to be part of that anymore. So that they will not submit to any point of view other than his own, not even if it came traditionally from God himself. Exaggerated excuses, which however in God's hands became the means for saving humanity. Rav Hirsch suggests that because the individual is being drawn into this community, he needed to awaken within the individual their own sense of self. To the expense that that individual will abandon whatever someone else is telling him, even Hashem himself. But that it was worth it to play up the sense of the individual because humanity was at stake. Because if the individual would be willing to go along with this plan, he would be lost. And all individuals would be lost. And that's too great a risk. So that I made each individual become so aware of himself and his own value that they refused to be subordinate to any major picture. Even if it would come at an expense where some individuals could now say, I don't even want to listen to God either. I'm sure some of us know some people like that. Where does that come from? It comes from such a sense of, we've heard this all the time, if someone says, if someone can prove to me that God exists, or if he can prove to me that this makes sense to me, I'll do it, but otherwise I won't. That's a very healthy sense that I will make my own decisions and I will not be told by anyone what to do. I don't care who they are. So the first, God awoken that in the individual person in the time of this dispersion to protect humanity from being going along with the major project that would have led to their demise. Skipping down to the underline at the end of the next paragraph, towards the bottom of the page. Thus it came about that the one no longer understood the other, because, let me fill in what he had said, because when I become so involved in myself, the way that that will affect itself will eventually come out in the language. Because the universal language says, the way that you need to look at it is like this. This is the only way to look at it, it's objective. And as the healthy sense of self becomes greater, what develops is, don't tell me how to look at things, I'll look at things the way I see it, and do things the way that I want to do. And it's not long after that the subjective nature of language, the different way of expressing oneself, the different way of defining something, comes about from an awakening of that individual about himself, will bring about a different way of expressing yourself. Because in the same way that we see the result of that thousands of years later, where different cultures express things differently because they value things differently, so when the individual begins, that starts from the individual who has such a healthy sense of self that he refuses to be told how to look at things, to look at things in his own way. Then refers his language, thus it came about that the one no longer understood the other. The one would call something by quite a different name just out of spite. For independence shows itself in obstinacy of thought, of one's own way of looking at things. So that the disunion did not arise out of a number of languages, but the other way around. Says the first, listen to this, this is going to answer, that one line answers the big question that we ask. Why does Hashem choose language? Like, what a funny thing to pull out of your grab bag to stop a tower. If you want to stop a tower, drop a bomb on them. Drop some sulfur and some burning rain like he did at Stone. Says the first, he did it the other way around. How did he stop it? Because the real problem was the individual was just going along with the program. And they were going to be sucked in. And we were going to lose the individual. And that was the purpose of creation. So how do I stop that? I boost up the healthy sense of self. I make each person feel so strong about themselves, obstinate to the point of rebellion against everything else that's out there. What comes out as a result of that? You're going to start speaking different languages. Because I'm not going to let you tell me how to think. I'm not going to let your language determine how things should be called, what they should reflect, and what they should represent. Because I see them my own way. So that the dispersion of language or the confusion of language came about Not that magically, if you'd ask people on the street, like, how did it happen? So I think the common knowledge would be, like, in a flash, all of a sudden, everybody just started, this one started, they're all speaking Hebrew, and they're all saying, this one started speaking French, this one started speaking Spanish, this one started speaking Portuguese, this one started speaking English, and like, they all woke up one morning, they're all speaking different languages, and they don't understand each other. So the first thing that happened, they all became so involved in themselves, in rebellion against the community, because that was destroying humanity, that out of that, they began to speak different languages. Because from independence comes different ways of looking at things. And language is a reflection of that. And therefore, from that came different languages. And therefore, they were dispersed. The pasuk that we ask, why did Hashem disperse? They did on their own, because that's the next step. When we don't speak the same language, because we don't see things the same way, what do we do with people who we just can't get along with because we don't see things the same way? We go our own ways. We like to be around people who are like-minded. We don't like being around people who are not like us. The brilliance of community is holding people together who don't necessarily all think exactly the same, because it's still better for us. But it's hard to do, because as soon as there are enough people of a critical mass who think differently, what do? They always break off. We always have struggled with this from the beginning of time. As soon as there's a critical enough mass that we can say, hey, we're a little subgroup and we think differently than those people, let's form our own group. Be it shul, be it community, be it school, you name it. When it's small enough, we'll stick together because we have to. But as soon as we don't have to, we go. Says the first, that's the progression. First, Hashem comes down and boosts up their sense of self. They become independent. They don't see things the same way. They don't speak the same language. And it's not far after that that everybody then wants to go their own way, because they want nothing to do with each other, because they're so independent. What we struggle with as a result of all this is that sense of self. And now we have to fight that in submitting ourselves to Hashem and His will, because we're still now, we have a very boosted sense of independence and self. We don't want to listen to anything. We're very obstinate when it comes to that. But that was to save humanity, says Refersh, from the disunion. That's that last line again. I'll read it again on 2:16, the bottom. So that the disunion did not arise out of a number of languages, but the other way around. First there were a number of languages, and then that created the disunion and the separating. 2:17, the underlying part there. Accordingly, they left off building the city, but the propensity towards it, that they took everywhere with them. This idea is what the struggle, the idea of community coming together for its own sake, is always a threat throughout humankind. Of course, no more a city and a tower for the enslavement of the whole of mankind, but single cities and towers here and there, from which little Nimrod thought they could reach the skies. We've always had pharaohs, paros and others, the Napoleons, trying to bring people together for their own particular sake, for the greatness of itself, and not for God's purpose. The universal history, the next underlying part, the universal history of the world is left to take its course until the time of the prophets, whose eyes were again opened to the time in which the ever-repeated downfall of all that great and small buildings to the fame of man will finally bring mankind to the conviction that there is only one name to whose glorification mankind has all. Very long sentences in the original German that are translated. So we continue going down this part, basically, until there'll be a time when Mashiach will come, and we will see that it's not about constructing things for our own sake. It's not about making our own names great. It's not about bonding and banding together. It's because that makes greatness, but for the sake of God, when we band together, when we become an entity, that we can create so much more. And he concludes with a pasuk that I brought in full on that second sheet. And you'll see in this pasuk, after reading this story, the beauty of this pasuk, this is from the prophet Zephaniah, towards the end of Tanakh, in the Treasar. Ki az, describing the end of days, I should say, the Navi, describing what will be in the end of days, Ki oz ehefoch el amim, then I will change the nations, safav rura, to speak a pure language. So to the beauty of the way the prophet describes it, what will be in the times of Mashiach? We will all speak a safav rura. Not a confused language, a pure language. Rikro kulam b'shem Hashem. What did they want to do in the tower? Naselanu shame. Let's make ourselves a great name. And the prophet says, when Mashiach comes, we will all go back to a pure language, not a confused language. One pure language. For what purpose? Likro b'shem Hashem, to worship Him with united resolve. Literally going back to what was. Parak Yud Aleph, chapter 11 in Bereishis. Everybody's speaking one language. They all are in agreement. B'shem Hashem. And in this story, they diverge from that purpose. They all speak the same language, but they're doing it for their own name. Naselanu Shem. What's the response when they want to do it for themselves? I can't have such power. When there's a united language and they're all unified, but they're doing it for themselves, mankind is at stake because the individual is going to get crushed. He doesn't exist. So how do I address that? I have to take away their language. I have to build up the individual. They are obstinate. They don't want to be part of that. Different languages will develop. Dispersion will happen. When Mashiach comes, where are we headed? Back together to a Safa V'ruah, to one pure language, one pure purpose, one pure goal, where it's no longer Nasa Lanu Shem for ourselves, but the Krov B'Shem Hashem, to call in the name of Hashem, where we take that power and that beauty, all to be able to be for Hashem's sake. And that will bring us back to where we started, where a world from Pasuk Aleph was all speaking Safa Chasu Dvarim Achadim, one language with one unified words, and we'll get back to that point where we all speak that same language, the Lashon HaKodesh, the objective universal reality language. We will get back to speaking that language. Have a great night.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.